Hey everyone, before we start this episode of the Power Records podcast, I just want to mention that it is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 45% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. The two books that I'm going to recommend this time, as you might imagine, are Planet of the Apes related. The first is Planet of the Apes Trade Paperback Volume 1, the collection of the first four issues from Boom Studios. Have you always wondered what happened before the first original five films? This is the trade to read, and Boom Studios' Planet of the Apes comic series is monthly must-reading. Get your hands on these damn dirty apes. The writer is Daryl Gregory. The artist is Carlos Magno. Page count is 112. Normal price is $9.99. InStock Trades price is only $6.99. That is 30% off. And then related to that is Planet of the Apes Cataclysm Trade Paperback Volume 1 by Karina Bekcho and Gabriel Hardman, who is one of my favorite artists and we talk about in the show. The end is just beginning. 8 years before astronaut George Taylor fell from the stars fell on the Planet of the Apes. Once the destroyer of human civilization, the Alpha Omega Bomb of Yore has slept silent in the dark side of the moon. One mad monk seems to wake the beast, and all of ape society is at risk. Cover for this particular volume is by Alex Ross. Completely awesome. Normal price is $14.99. InStock Trades price is $10.49. That is 30% off. So for all these and your other trade paperback needs, visit InStockTrades.com, and we thank them for their support.
Power Records presents
Welcome to another episode of the Power Records podcast, where the action comes alive. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is a very, very special episode of the Power Records podcast. It is Apes Month, officially here at the Power Records podcast. Well, I shouldn't say it's Apes Month. This is the Apes episode of the Power Records podcast. I have a very special guest with me here. Joining us for the first half of this double-length show is a big, big Planet of the Apes fan, podcaster extraordinaire, Scott Gardner. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate the invite.
Hey, we are very, very happy to have you here. Now, as I mentioned, over the Two True Freaks Network, it was Apes Month. Just ended being Apes Month in anticipation of the new movie, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which comes out on July 11th. So I figured it was the perfect time to talk about the Planet of the Apes Power Records, of which there were four, not five, four, even though there were five movies. And knowing Scott is such a big Apes fan, I thought it would be great to have him on. So what we're going to do is we are going to talk about the first two Planet of the Apes records, Planet of the Apes, and then Beneath Planet of the Apes. And then in the second half of the show, my regular Power Records co-host, Chris Franklin, a.k.a. Earth 2 Chris, will be joining me for Escape from the Planet of the Apes and Battle for the Planet of the Apes. So we're going to do all four in one shot. It is an Apeapalooza here. Before we get started, though, Scott, why do you love the apes so much? How did you discover this whole world?
It's funny because while we were doing Apes Month, I was really racking my brains trying to think where exactly did I discover Planet of the Apes, because Planet of the Apes and I were both released in the same year. we both came out in 1968, so obviously I didn't see the original movie in theater. To the best of my knowledge, I didn't see any of the Planet of the Apes movies either in a theater or at the drive-in movies. They had all long been out by the time I kind of discovered them as a kid. My earliest Planet of the Apes memory, honestly, was when I was living in Florida as a child. We lived in Tampa up until about 1975. So I was less than 7 years old, and I can remember playing with some neighbor kids. And one of the neighbor kids had some Planet of the Apes Migos and the Migo Planet of the Apes treehouse playset. And I think that must have been my first exposure to them. And I must have had at least an inkling of who they were, because I don't remember being like, oh, what are these? You know, I recognized them somehow. So I don't know if that would have come from seeing them on TV or maybe the I'm trying to remember what year the animated series was, the cartoon series was on. I want to say that was like three or four, I think.
I think 74, I think.
So I may have known them from like Saturday morning or something. I'm not sure, but I remember that the kid, the only figure I can remember distinctly was that he had a chimpanzee, and I don't know who it, well, I don't know if it was Cornelius or who it was, but he had the chimpanzee figure and the treehouse. He may have had other figures too, but that's the only one I can distinctly remember because I've wanted one all my life, you know, and I've still to this day, I've never acquired a Planet of the Apes, Mego. I never had any as a kid, but I always thought they were really cool. And that's my earliest memory, of apes, honestly. And I can remember also, you know, how Power Records ties in for me is, I had a distant cousin. It was like the son of one of my mom's cousins or something like that, you know, like distant relations that I don't really, even to this day, I don't really know them very well or exactly how I'm related, right, or anything, right. But we would go visit, you know, every couple of years or whatever. We would drive up, they lived in the Messina, New York area. And, I can't even remember the kid's name, but he was a year or two older than I was. And he had a collection of Power Records, and he had a lot of really cool ones like $6 Million Man and stuff. And he had Beneath the Planet of the Apes. And I can remember us sitting down and listening to it and thumbing along with the book, you know, as the record would play and everything, and just being fascinated by it. And so those are the earliest memories I can really think of before I got, like, when I got seriously into apes, honestly, wasn't until it had to be the early 90s because I had just gotten out of the Air Force in 1990, and I went straight into video sales as video sales was just becoming a thing.
Right.
And I worked in a local mall where I lived at the time in upstate New York, and I worked for a place called Saturday Matinee.
Oh, I remember them.
And apes started to come out on Fox Video. And I can remember that there was a great commercial that they used to play on our regular, I think they were produced in-house, I'm not sure, but it was part of the, whatever company it was that owned Saturday Matinee, I think it was Trans World Media or something like that. They used to make these play tapes that would change every couple of months or something. And they incorporated the 20th Century Fox promotional loop about the apes into our store play tape, which was essentially just a bunch of movie trailers.
Right, right.
And I just became fascinated, like, oh yeah, I remember those movies, some of them, and being really fascinated. So as they came out on video, I started buying them up and just fell in love all over again. And that really is where my love of apes really got reignited, was when they hit video, because up to that point, beyond the first movie, I don't know that I had ever sat and watched the remaining four in the series, like, start to finish. So that was really where I got to, like, sit down and actually pay attention and learn, like, the history and the proper order the movies came out and all that. Up to that point, it was all just one of those things that would play, you know, on TV, and it was like catch as catch can, you know, when they would be on TV or whatever, so...
Yeah, that's funny. You and I have nearly parallel histories with that because, yeah, I'm just too young to – I never saw any of them in the theater. And I remember having some of the Marvel comics, and I had some of the Power Records. But, yeah, they were sort of dormant for a while. And then when I worked at a video store in the early 90s, and we had the Apes movies, and that's where I got to learn – okay, then there's this one, then this, oh, wow, you know, like that kind of thing. Remember them all. And I remember taking them all home and watching them in a very short period of time and being really impressed that, like, you know, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here, but really being impressed that, like, unique among movie franchises, they really develop the story through each film.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
This is not a stagnant franchise. I mean, each movie is almost like trying to screw over the next set of filmmakers by trying to come up with the most ridiculous, you know what I mean? It's like, okay, make a sequel to this, you know?
Exactly,
you're like,
yeah.
Okay, we just had Charlton Heston blow up the world. Yep. All right, well, you know. And I don't think you would almost see that nowadays of where a film franchise would just go so far out on a limb in terms of, you know, risking the whole franchise by making this movie or, you know, lead you to this story dead end. But, you know, it was the 70s.
I never really thought of it that way before, but you're right. It's almost like, I don't know if you remember a series called DC Challenge.
Oh, sure.
But it is almost like that. It's like, okay, we killed the hero and we blew up the whole planet. Now make a sequel, you know?
You know, it's like very nihilistic attitude back then. But yeah, that's just how I remember them. And, you know, I've gone back and enjoyed the movies. And I think I had some of the Mego toys. I had so many Mego toys. I probably had at least one or two of them. My parents probably had no idea what they were buying me. It was just, a gorilla doll. Okay, that's fine. That works just as well. So
glad that you mentioned the Marvel comics, by the way, because I feel like a dope that I forgot entirely to mention them. And here we covered them on there's another show on our network called Back to the Bins. It's all all looking back at mostly vintage comics, you know, mostly older comics. And for 4 weeks on that show, we also looked at the history and the different incarnations of apes in the comic books. And of course, we talked about the Marvel comics. And I did have a couple of those as a kid. You know, they had the black and white magazine, right. And then there was the reprint that was the standard comic size Adventures on the Planet of the Apes. I had some of those too. I'd entirely forgotten.
Yeah, and they pushed those stories pretty far too. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. Those were a lot of those were written by Doug Mensch. I never knew Mensch.
Mensch.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, he was a guy that, you know, you really wanted to push a story in crazy directions. You know, if you couldn't get Bob Haney, you could get Doug Mensch to do it. And
right.
They did some stuff. I mean, there was, we probably get off on a whole other tangent, but there was some crazy stuff for those Planet of the Apes comics. So there was, you know, these apes things were fertile ground for creative people. So. We should get going. We should get going on the first story. This is going to be the first audio adventure. It is Power Records' adaptation of Planet of the Apes. As you might expect, it's incredibly abbreviated, but it gets basically the gist of it. But we'll talk about that on the other side of it. So without further ado, enjoy this first Power Record, Planet of the Apes.
Planet of the Apes. Three astronauts traveling in a state of suspended animation approach their destination after 18 months in a spacecraft flying at the speed of light, only to make an unprogrammed splashdown into a vast, foreboding lake. What went wrong?
I don't know. She went under before I could listen to the tapes.
Be thankful that this air isn't as poisonous as it looks.
Gone. We're here to stay.
But where are we? And even more important, when? According to Haslein's theory of time in a vehicle moving at the speed of light...
Mother Earth will have aged a couple of thousand years while we have outlived everyone we knew while we have scarcely aged at all.
Great. Stranded 2,000 years in the future on a lifeless planet revolving around some unknown star.
Lifeless is right. Nothing can grow here. That lake we landed in is almost pure salt.
Don't give up too soon. We have 3 days worth of food and water. 3 days to find life on a dead planet. Landon, coming?
In a minute.
Ha! And I thought you were ready to give up.
The astronauts' trek for life takes them across a bleak and hostile landscape. I can't figure this place. There's a thick cloud of dust, but it's as humid as a jungle. Lightning and thunder, but no rain. I give up. I can't drag my feet.
Don't dodge. Don't move your feet.
What is it?
It's life.
Then we're going to make it. Listen, that roar. Is it a waterfall?
That is beautiful.
Don't drink till I test it. It's okay.
Let me at it.
Hold it. Company. So much for our dead planet theory. Hello!
That's the old charm, Taylor. Who or what were they?
That footprint looks human.
Maybe you guys didn't notice, but that pretty one looked very human.
Hey, not bad for a 2,000-year-old man. Here's their trail. They looked like primitive men. I think we've found a Stone Age culture.
You know, I think we could become big shots on this planet.
A rifle shot? In the Stone Age? The primitives are being hunted down by gorillas on horseback.
Suddenly, the spectators become part of the hunt.
Look out! They're after us, too!
Dodge! Ah! Landon, this is madness!
Seeing Dodge shot dead and Landon trampled, Taylor makes a desperate run for freedom, only to find himself facing one of the ground gorillas who have been flushing out the terrified primitives. In a blind rage, Taylor seizes the long stick from the surprised hunter, and the beater finds himself being beaten.
This is for Dodge, and this is for Landon, and...
A rifle cracks, and Taylor feels fire at his throat.
A really vicious beast.
All the more reason to wipe them all out. But I'm sure the animal psychologist will want to save this one for experiments.
After a long period of blackness, Taylor's mind swims back to consciousness. He finds himself strapped down, and dimly he realizes he is receiving blood. Then he passes out again.
This is the one with the strange clothes?
Yes, Dr. Zira. He's lost a lot of blood. I don't know why we're bothering to save him. Filthy humans.
Taylor wakes for good to discover he is living his nightmare. He is caged like an animal in an animal hospital.
Good morning, Bright Eyes. You interest me, Bright Eyes. Oh, I won't hurt you. I'm an animal psychologist. But how can I explain that to you? I'm convinced that humans have great intelligence. If only you had the gift of speech.
Taylor stares in amazement at the talking chimp. He tries to answer, but his throat wound has robbed him of speech. Now it is Zira's turn to stare in amazement at the dumb human who seems to be mouthing words.
Bright Eyes, are you imitating my mouth movements?
In frustration, Taylor suddenly grabs the psychologist's clipboard and pencil.
Hey, give that back. I warn you not to get too close, Dr. Zira. All humans are vicious beasts.
But Zira is shaken to the core by Taylor's note. My name is Taylor. Zira shows Taylor's note to her fiancé.
Cornelius, I tell you, he has ape intelligence.
A human wrote this?
He could prove your theory about a missing link between the lowly human beast and the civilized ape.
Yes, yes. Dr. Zaius would have to let me pursue my archaeological research then. A writing human. If only he could talk.
Meanwhile, Taylor has recovered his self-control.
Nova, is that what they call you? Thanks for saving my life. Hey, I'm talking. My voice has come back.
Several days later.
We've come for the one called Bright Eyes.
It's Taylor, not Bright Eyes.
I've told the authorities about your talking trick, Bright Eyes. Now you'll see what comes of being too clever. They'll remove your brain to study it.
Suddenly, realizing his helplessness, Taylor struggles vainly.
He's strong for a human.
I club him, but Dr. Zaius wants him in an inquiry.
In collar and leash, Taylor is led through the door of a forbidding inquiry room.
Dr. Zira, I can talk.
Shh, I heard about it. And Cornelius and I arranged this inquiry to try to save your life.
The inquiry is a fiasco. In vain does Taylor try to tell his story.
We came from outer space, from a distant planet called Earth.
Nonsense. Dr. Cornelius, do you believe this preposterous nonsense?
Not entirely, Dr. Zaius, but he does accurately describe the eastern desert region where I made my archaeological discoveries.
Your discoveries were scientific heresy, and you have been forbidden to speak of them. I am a fair ape, Bright Eyes, but as Minister of Science, I believe in proof. The companions you spoke of, could they confirm this wild tale?
One is dead at your hands. The other, I don't know. Perhaps he was also captured.
Very well. Let us see if your fictitious astronaut friend can be found among the survivors of the hunt in which you were captured, Taylor.
Taylor, do not antagonize them needlessly. Our careers are in jeopardy and your life.
You don't fully believe me either, do you, Zira? That's him, Landon, on the left. Landon! John, it's me, Taylor.
Let him approach, guards.
You vicious savages. You've removed his frontal lobe.
Return that animal to his cage before he gets violent.
Beaten and hauled back to imprisonment, Taylor gives in to his despair.
Nova, this place is insane, mad. For some reason, they fear me, want to destroy me. How can I fight them? I'm all alone.
I've come for this male. He's to be transferred to the zoo.
Says who?
Dr. Zaius, read it for yourself.
This is no good. It's not signed.
Hit him, Bright Eyes! I'm Lucius, Aunt Zira's nephew. We've arranged your escape.
The girl!
Under cover of darkness, Zira leads Taylor and Nova to a wagon.
Be quiet, and we may manage this. All men look alike to most apes. We will meet Cornelius in the East Desert at his archaeological excavation. He and I must clear ourselves of the heresy charge.
Their luck holds, and after a long, tense ride...
I'll take this rifle! Nobody's going to capture me again!
Cornelius leads the group to a strange and somehow magnificent cavern. I want you to see my archaeological digs and perhaps some surprises even for you, Taylor.
I can't believe this! Spectacles, dentures, beautiful silverware. Cornelius, this represents a civilization more advanced than yours.
I know. Therein lies the heresy. Our schools teach that the ape evolved from the animal human. Have they been teaching us lies?
Necessary lies. For the protection of our race, and for which, unfortunately, you must all die.
Dr. Zaius, in the interest of science...
In the interest of survival, Dr. Cornelius, killer humans must be forever kept in their place.
No more gobbledygook talk!
At the speed of a cat, Taylor bounds to the cave entrance and pins Dr. Zaius.
In the interest of our survival, Zaius, send back your guards or you perish!
Taylor, you wouldn't!
Of course he would. What are your terms, killer human?
You're a fine one to speak of killing. I want freedom for the girl and myself, plus a good horse and a pardon for my friends.
Granted.
Dr. Zira, I'd like to kiss you goodbye.
Of course, Bright Eyes. But I do wish you weren't so ugly.
Am I safe in untying you, Dr. Zaius?
I am an ape of my word. But you realize the cave must be sealed up.
I can't fight you, Dr. Zaius, but the humans, what will become of them?
They go to meet their destiny.
Just hold tight, Nova! What's that up ahead? Oh, no! No! Nova! Now all the pieces come together. This is my planet Earth 2,000 years in the future. And my civilization destroyed itself. Oh, Nova, Nova, you are what is left of the human race.
Can you believe it? They were on Earth the whole time. So that's Planet of the Apes. I have so many things to mention here, but Scott, what do you think of this, the Power Records version of Planet of the Apes?
I think it's a hoot. I get a real kick out of it. I love the voice acting in it. Mm-hmm. It's always a trip, you know, down memory lane to listen to this, but I get a kick out of it every time I listen to it. But probably the biggest thing that I get a kick out of and surprises me simultaneously is, you know, arguably the biggest moment in the entire movie, arguably the biggest moment in the Planet of the Apes franchise, the classic franchise, is the chase through Ape City when Taylor escapes for the first time, that culminates with him being netted.
Right.
And giving that classic line, you know, get your hands off me, you dirty apes. And it's totally excised from this adaptation. I think that's hysterical that they managed to make it work, even though they're working around, you know, the big moment of the movie.
Yeah.
I'm just floored by that. I think it's hysterical. But it works. This, to me, is my favorite kind of now, granted, it's a book and record, but basically it's a comic book adaptation. It's my favorite kind of comic book adaptation where you're seeing it through almost like a parallel dimension because it's a little off. It's not verbatim with the movie. It's, certain scenes are done a little bit differently. Now, it doesn't really give you any, like, DVD extras like a classic Marvel adaptation would a lot of times give you scenes that weren't in the movie, for example. It doesn't really do that because it's extremely pared down, but I really get a kick out of the kind of the alternate take, if you will, that it has on a lot of scenes to still essentially tell you the same story, but both abbreviate it and present it for essentially for children so that it's violent, but it's not too violent.
I'm jumping around. I'm shocked that for a children's record, they leave in the idea that the other astronaut got a got his frontal lobe removed.
Right.
They left that in. it's not as gruesome here. You just see a little scar on his forehead, as opposed to the big shot in the movie where you see the big section, you know, the lobotomy. That was the word I was ironically blanking on. But here it's, you just see the scar. But still, they actually left that in. But at the same time, when the astronauts go earlier in the story and they jump into the pool, they're all wearing clothes. In the movie, they take their clothes off.
Right.
And you actually see male rear nudity in a G-rated movie, which would never happen again. But here they're all jumping in their clothes. Something else that I hadn't realized that it had never dawned on me how important, at least to me, that ram's horn music is in the film.
Yes.
And the first shot of the apes on the horseback is accompanied by the roar sound, and that's not in this. And it almost feels wrong to not. I was listening to this version. I kept waiting to hear the ram horn kick in when they show the apes, but it never comes. And you're like, huh? Okay. It just, it really does cast the whole thing in a very different, you know, has a really different feel to it without that music. The art is uncredited. It says story adaptation and art design by Arvid Knudsen and Associates, but that's clearly some sort of graphic design firm they hired. The art looks like Ernie Chan or Ernie Chua. He went by both names. It looks like that to me. I can't verify that, but it looks like that.
It does. It looks like him, and sometimes some of the inks almost look like I think his name was Nestor Redondo.
Nestor Redondo. Yeah. Yeah.
I would not be at all surprised to find out that it was those fellas that worked on it. That's definitely the style of the art, whether it is distinctly them or not.
A nice little bonus is on the inside cover, and I'll post some of these images on our Tumblr, fireandwaterpodcast.tumblr.com. On the inside cover is a drawing by John Romita of all the various Power Record stars all in one shot. So you've got Dracula, Captain America, Hulk, Human Torch, Spider-Man, Thing, Man-Thing, Werewolf by Night, Frankenstein, and the apes from Planet of the Apes all in one shot.
Oh, wow.
The only time you're ever going to see all these various differently trademarked characters.
I need to see that because I have this. Unfortunately, I do not own this myself. I have this as a I think this is a PDF file that looking at here, and it's just the cover story, so it does not show the promotional thing. Yeah, I would love to see that.
Yes, the inside cover has them all, which I like. You know, it's those long ago days of where you could mix copyrights. You know, that's over now for the most part, but I do enjoy that. And you know, it's funny, when I was listening to this the other day, I listened to it and then I went back and looked at the comic, and nowhere in the audio track does Taylor, who, by the way, is the same actor, I don't know the name of the actor, but it's the same actor who played Spider-Man in all the other Power Records, except for Mark of the Man-Wolf.
Is that
Spider-Man.
Right?
Yeah.
I wondered if you might know his name, because I recognized his voice. He was Captain America in the old Marvel, I don't know if you ever watched the Marvel 60s cartoons that used to be on
the artwork sliding across the screen.
Right, yeah, that was the one. And he was Cap, and what was funny is his voice jumped out to me right away when I first listened to these again after, you know, I don't know how many decades it's been, you know, since I've listened to these as a kid. But I listened to them a few weeks ago when we were first starting to do kind of our homework for Apes Month on Two True Freaks. And then I listened to it yesterday in the car, driving back and forth to work, you know, just to refresh myself. And again, I recognize his voice as Cap. But I think one of the other actors on this may have been Bucky on there as well. But I could not find anywhere that would confirm that at all. I couldn't even find the guy's name.
Yeah, these credits are lost to the ages. I've said this on the other Power Records episodes and on Fire and Water occasionally. We're like, I really wish somebody would hire me to do like a coffee table book of the Power Records and research all this, because all this information is just gone. It's just. you can't find anything. I mean, I have my Power Records blog that I did briefly for a couple of years, powerrecord.blogspot.com. But I couldn't find anything about these things other than, you know, a couple little bits here and there about Rich Buckler did some of the art or whatever. But, yeah, it's really hard to find this information for some reason. Because the actor that played Spider-Man in the Mark of the Man-Wolf record is Peter Fernandez, who was the voice of Speed Racer. It's the same guy. He only played Spider-Man that one time in the Mark of the Man-Wolf. The actor who played Spider-Man in all the other Power Records adventures is the same guy who plays Taylor here. So, you know, Power Records clearly had a tiny group of actors that they just pulled from over and over and over again. So it was sort of almost distracting to hear Taylor sound so much like Spider-Man. But the thing I was mentioning was nowhere in the audio does Taylor ever say it's the Statue of Liberty. So if you're just listening to the audio, you don't know what the big reveal is. I mean, right. Of course you know what the big reveal is because everybody knows what the big reveal is. But they never say it. He just goes, I've been home all this time. No, and that's the end. And you have to look at the comic where you see the final page of the giant Statue of Liberty buried in the sand and stuff. So, although the final paragraph here, Taylor is much more verbose because he goes, oh, no, Nova, now all the pieces come together. This is my planet Earth, 2,000 years in the future, and my civilization destroyed itself. Oh, Nova, you are what is left of the human race. So it's a little more of a sweet ending. The movie ends on a little more grim note, of course. You know, like you said, it's a perfectly fine adaptation. I mean, you know, for a fairly complex story and with a lot of adult stuff in it, they do a pretty good job of condensing this down for kids. Yeah, they really did.
Oh, I thought they did a really good job. The one sequence that I get the biggest kick out of, though, again, goes back into the fact that they skip the chase. They skip Taylor escaping and being captured and delivering his famous line from the movie. So how it plays here is actually really funny. You've got Taylor steals the notepad from Dr. Zira, just like he does in the movie. He writes, you know, my name is Taylor on the thing. And then she leaves, and she takes the note to Cornelius, yeah. And they discuss the whole thing that, hey, you know, maybe this could prove your theory and all that. We go back to Taylor in jail, and it's funny because he's hitting on Nova in the next cell. And his line is, Nova, is that what they call you? And I'm thinking, they who? Now, I guess potentially maybe he's talking about Zira and the other apes, maybe. But when I first read that, I'm thinking like one of the other humans told it, like he said, hey, buddy, what's her name? But none of them speak. So I'm like, who told him what her name was? I just thought that was funny. But he suddenly realizes that his voice comes back. So you've got this last panel on page 11. He's saying, hey, I'm talking. My voice has come back. You turn the page, and the caption box is several days later is when they come and they get him and take him to trial. So he goes to the tribunal, and there he sees Zira and Cornelius, presumably for the first time in days, and says, Dr. Zira, I can talk. And she says, I heard about it. I'm thinking, whoa, that's a way different scenario than in the movie.
Talk about burying the lead, you know? Jeez. Yeah, that is. That's like the big moment of the movie, and here it takes place off camera. That's pretty amazing.
Right.
I'm just trying to imagine the poor writer they assigned to condense this movie into, you know, into a comic book form, into 20 pages of story. You know, that had to be a two-hour movie with all these complex ideas, and you had to condense it to these 20 pages. Like that could not have been a fun task.
But, you know, they do a fair job of it, though, because while it does lose much of the action, it does retain most of the story and even a little bit of the social commentary and the political commentary, which, again, that's very interesting for what is essentially a child's book.
Yeah.
They boil it down to its essentials, but they didn't lose the overall flavor of the story, which I thought was very nice.
There's one little detail that I don't even know if I should mention, but when else am I going to mention it? And maybe I'm crazy. But on page 18, they're in the cave, and Taylor has his rifle, and Zaius is saying, in the interest of survival, Dr. Cornelius, killer humans must be forever kept in their place. And then Taylor fires at them, and he goes, no more gobbledygook talk. Now, I don't know about you, but as far as I have ever heard that word, it's gobbledygook, not gobbledygook. I've never heard that.
Very funny that you say that, because while I was listening to the record, I heard him say gobbledygook, and I rewound it because I'm like, no, that's not right. It must be a skip in the record or something. And I went back and I listened again, and I'm like, no, sure enough, he misspoke and he said gobbledygook. But I never thought to look at the book.
And
the,
yep.
And yeah. Sure enough, it is misspelled there too. Yeah, so he actually read it correctly based on how the script reads. But yeah, to my understanding, that word is gobbledygook,
and
not gobbledygook. So that's very strange.
My intimation, my assumption on that, again, I could be completely wrong, but I think about when this was made. This record was made in like 1974. The Vietnam War is still going on, and that particular racial epithet was
right
in, you know, people did use it. And I have to wonder if even within buried in this larger word, Power Records was just like, you know what? We don't even want that in there. I don't know why you could have used 1,000 other words instead of gobbledygook. You could have said no more stupid talk, no more ape talk, no more any. But it just, that jumps out at me, because it's like, that's not a thing. Gobbledygook is not a thing. This is not a word. And I just have to wonder if that was somebody at Power Records just being extra sensitive to the time and just saying, all right, just change it. You know, what's the difference? I could be completely nuts, probably overthinking it, but it just jumped out of me when I heard him say it, you know. I always mention on the show about the different formats. They said this was issued as a 45 book and record set, as the ones Scott and I are talking about. And then Power Records never met a repurpose. They didn't love. They re-put all four of these stories on an LP as well. So they got a lot of use out of these. They did it as 45s, and then they did it as an LP. So you could get it in multiple different formats.
I've always liked the back cover on these.
Yeah,
it was the Power Records take on that classic reissue poster where they put the movies back in the cinemas again, and they would run them all five in a marathon. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think it said 20th Century Fox wants you to go ape. In this case, it says Power Records Books and Records want you to go ape. I love this, though.
Yeah, yeah.
It's good stuff.
It haunts me, too. It says it lists Power Records' address, and it's Newark, New Jersey. That's not that that's not that far from here, you know? Think about it. It's like, geez, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I was only like a good hour and a half away from where they made the Power Records. That would have been a great tour to take as a kid, but... Oh, well, you know. So, okay, well, listen, that's Planet of the Apes. We are now going to listen to part two, which is Beneath the Planet of the Apes. So sit back, enjoy the wanton destruction that takes place in this sequel, and we'll talk about it on the other side.
Beneath the Planet of the Apes.
Man has always peered fearfully into the future, dreading the glimpse that will show him all his dreams turned to dust. Several thousand years into our future, this man, Astronaut Taylor, has had his glimpse of nightmare. He clings to sanity, but only barely.
So now I know. I've traveled through a time warp in space thousands of years into the future and back to my own planet. And now I know that sometime after I left, my people went the way of nuclear destruction. If only they could see their legacy. What's left of the world is topsy-turvy. Apes, talking apes, rule Earth. Humans are mute animals, like you, my lovely Nova. Where do we go from here? Back there are the apes thirsting for my blood. Ahead? What? Well, be it ever so humble. That was home, Nova, but it's certain that nobody's home now to welcome us. Fire! How? What's feeding it? The fire's gone. I don't get it. Either I've lost my mind or... But you saw it, Nova, and the horse. Let's try again. Whoa! I don't know what's happening here, but I'll have to go ahead alone, Nova. Wear this, Nova. If anything happens, go back to Ape City. Find Zira. Zira, the chimpanzee psychologist. She'll help you. And keep away from the gorillas.
Ice?
Am I having hallucinations? Is there something supernatural trying to block my way? I'll hack my way through.
Ice and Taylor both. The grim wreckage of a great city shimmers in an eerie stillness as silent as Nova's scream. Distraught and bewildered, Nova rides aimlessly toward a sight that will only confuse her more.
Skipper, speak to me. It's Brent. Skipper, hang on.
Where are we?
I don't know. We were following Taylor's exact trajectory and probably duplicated his fate. I don't know where we are, but the smashed instruments tell us when. 3955 A.D.
You shouldn't joke at a time. A time?
Skipper! What a fool's errand. Searching for a lost fish. Now there are two. Hello. Oh, no. I'm dreaming. None of this is true. You don't smash up a spaceship and step out to meet a beautiful ragamuffin out for a morning canter. I am friend. Brent. You understand?
Whoops.
No sale. Wait! I look for Taylor. Taylor!
The name strikes a responsive chord in Nova.
Taylor! We came down right on target.
To his dismay, Brent soon learns that Nova is mute.
Where? Where is Taylor? Well, nothing ventured. Let's look, huh? Maybe somebody around here can speak.
Under a slack rein, the horse heads for home.
I've never seen such desolation. We always thought there must be life on other planets. But who'd bet on one like this? Hey, vegetation! Things are looking up.
Brent's voice reminds Nova of Taylor. She is almost peaceful. Till her animal sharp eyes spot something.
Hey, what?
General Ursus has called for a giant rally at the arena tonight.
At last, action!
Gorillas? In uniform? On horseback? And talking? Wow! They'll never believe this back home. As soon as it's dark, baby, we find that arena.
I alone can lead you to victory over the unknown enemy that lurks in the forbidden zone. An enemy that threatens our very existence. Are they human? This threat to our ape civilization? If so, we shall wipe them out.
Something from mankind's past, seen in an ape's nightmare. Let's get away from here while we can.
Suddenly, Nova grabs Brent's arm and points at two chimpanzees slipping out of the arena.
The gorillas have gone mad, Zira. Imagine civilized apes going to war.
Not apes, Cornelius. Gorillas. They're not fit to be called apes. Oh, Nova.
You've come back. Is that Taylor with you?
No, I'm Brent. You know Taylor?
Another talking human. We had great affection for Taylor.
Zira saved him from death and worse at the hands of... But never mind. You must leave immediately. The gorillas lost for war. They've been seeking a pretext, and now scouts have disappeared in the forbidden zone. No human will be safe. Probably no chimpanzees either. Go! Do not fall into their hands.
Two chimpanzees disappear into the night.
They're gone. Nova, I've never met a girl with such interesting friends. War! War! I can smell it. Hey, either you're beginning to understand or you have a keen nose. You know, back home, the trouble with most women was that they talk too much.
Suddenly, the angry whine of a bullet.
Gorillas! Starting now, I follow my chimpanzee's advice.
Brent's skillful riding frustrates his pursuers. But as they race deep into the forbidden zone, to the outskirts of a molten ruin, the glassy crust beneath them gives way. Stunned, Brent vaguely hears the disappearing clatter of his horse's hooves. He squints at a great underground cavern.
Oh, no! Nova, do you realize? Taylor, you're telling me that he made the same discovery. This is Earth. My Earth. And mankind blew it. I wonder when. as if it makes any difference. No, is that light ahead? Is this an underground city or graveyard?
Suddenly, weird, compelling organ music fills the square.
Music? You hear it, Nova? Do you hear a voice, too? Come to the cathedral. The music is coming from there, but the voice is inside my head.
Speaking in a whisper, Brent holds Nova to the shadows.
They're praying. They're not making a sound, but I can hear their prayer. Oh, Lord, look what they're worshiping. An atomic bomb. Do you hear them? We reveal our inner selves to our Maker.
The strange worshippers pull at their faces. Despite himself, a strangled cry escapes Brent's. As he sees the ghastly heritage of atomic radiation, the bomb is indeed their Maker. Immediately, Brent and Nova are surrounded by mutants and bombarded by telepathic questions.
I'm from your past. I seek a man named Taylor. Please, cover your faces. Yes, I know Taylor. You mean he's alive? Temporarily? What do you mean?
Brent?
An incredible reunion.
I haven't seen you for 2,000 years. Yes, I should have left a message. Meet me in the cathedral under the atom bomb. That's the Alpha Omega bomb, Brent. Do you know what that means? That's the Doomsday Bomb, built as a deterrent to war back in the 1970s. Evidently, it didn't stop atomic warfare. But if that one had gone off, not even this much would have been left.
A chain reaction would have destroyed even the planet itself.
Exactly.
That is precisely why we worship it, as an instrument of peace.
You can speak.
Of course. We usually bypass such primitive communication, but with primitives...
Well, listen to this, primitive. Defuse that bomb. If the gorillas ever lay hands on it...
Gorillas?
Gorillas. Marching on this city right now.
The gorillas are indeed marching to the outskirts of the city, where they are stopped.
A great wall of fire! Our enemy is mighty.
Gorillas! How will they pass our wall of fire? Our bottomless chasm? Our precipice of ice?
Illusions! All illusions! What if they're all too thick to be frightened off?
Fate challenges Ursus to achieve greatness! Follow!
Amid the thunder of thousands of hoofs, the gorillas blindly follow their leader.
General, the flames have no heat.
Illusion! Our enemy hopes to defeat us with illusion!
Then they are clever. Perhaps too clever for us.
Nonsense! This means they are weak!
And the gorilla hordes ride over a chasm and through a precipice of ice.
Your Excellence, gorilla troops are streaming into our city.
The bomb! Let me try to defuse it.
You will stay where you are.
The mutant chief projects paralyzing thought waves.
My head! I can't move!
The power of the bomb will preserve peace.
Great doors burst open.
Halt or face destruction. Another mighty illusion, puny human.
Stop, both of you.
Enough play. So be it.
The bomb glows with deadly heat. In the hum of doom, Nova speaks her first and last word.
Taylor.
With this unspeakable explosion, the city once again, and for all time, is destroyed. And in the doomsday chain reaction, so also is the planet called Earth. And now we too have seen the future. Must it be our future? Now that we know, can we make sure it will not be?
And so the Earth is destroyed. The Earth is destroyed, Scott. The Earth is no more. There will be no more ape sequels. Of that we can be sure. Because how do you continue the story after you've blown up the world? That was beneath Planet of the Apes. And if Planet of the Apes was a strange thing to adapt into a children's record, beneath Planet of the Apes is even stranger. And right on the cover of this record, you see Taylor laying on the floor with an arrow in his back. So as he's setting off the device. So this is clearly not meant for children's fare, and yet here it is. So what do you think of this adaptation?
Oh, man, this thing is such a mixed bag. For one thing, the cover is hysterical because the Alpha Omega bomb looks like some weird, like, cross between, like, an elaborate fountain and, like, a pipe organ or something. You've got Taylor laying on the floor with an arrow in his spine, looking like he's using a cane to activate the controls. And then I guess these are supposed to be gorillas, but they're colored like chimps holding bows. So I'm like, where are there bows and arrows in this movie, for one thing?
Yeah,
Dr. Zaius looks like he has a beak. It's really a bizarre cover, but, you know, the bizarreness definitely does not stop at the cover. The whole thing, now, granted, Beneath is a very bizarre movie to begin with, so you're already adapting bizarre material, and it just is the trippiest, weirdest thing. They super condense it, which in this case I think actually helps the narrative, because I think Beneath is a little long to begin with. There's a lot of kind of slow parts, so it moves along at a brisk pace, but it is definitely a mixed bag. It's strange. I mean, to think that, you know, they took such a weird, trippy, violent and strange movie and adapted it for children just cracks me up.
Yeah. It is pretty remarkable. One of the things that, I guess we should mention, we'll get onto it when we do part two of the show. But as I mentioned earlier, like, there were 5 Planet of the Apes films, of course, in the original series, but there's only 4 Power Records. Now, how does that work? Is this like a weird Game of Thrones adaptation where they're moving things around? No. Power Records just simply skips over Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
Not only does it skip Conquest, but these two are actually out of order in the release order because, you know, you have, of course, the classic Planet of the Apes, and then theatrically you have Beneath and then Escape and then Conquest and then Battle. Well, when Power Records released their book and record adaptations, they did the classic Planet of the Apes, then they did Escape, and then they went back and did Beneath, and then they did Battle. So if you were a kid, and I knew kids like this when I was growing up in school, if you were a kid that didn't follow the movies or weren't able to see the movies or whatever, and you followed it strictly by these adaptations, I would think that you would be greatly confused by what the heck was going on.
I need an aspirin and I got to lie down. This makes
right.
No sense to me.
Yeah, because I knew a kid when I went to school. You know, my co-host on Two True Freaks, Chris Honeywell, he knew him too. We went to school together as a kid. His name was David Shell, and he was the son of our local pastor. And so he was not allowed to go to the theater as a child. So he was a huge Star Wars fan. But all of his Star Wars knowledge came from, like, the comic books and the novelization and, you know, the records and things like that. He had never actually seen the film. I can only imagine doing that with these and just being like, I can't follow this. Because, you know, you go from the first film to the apes coming back through time, you know, and everything that happens in Escape, and then going back to Taylor, and then the world, and wow, how confused would you be, you know?
Yeah. One of the things that they show in this adaptation, which I'm shocked that they do, is you get to see the mutants without their faces on.
Right.
And that was the thing. And in some ways, I don't know how you feel about it, but in some ways, to me, they look more gruesome here than they do in the movie.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, because they're your traditional hideous mutant freaks with the melty. They look almost like zombies.
Yeah.
They're very close to zombies. And, much more disturbing here than in the movie. And the movie ones are pretty disturbing as it is, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I mentioned this to Scott off the air, and I want to say it here. Is like a couple of, I think last year or so, I went and saw some friends of mine have a company where they run films in a theater, old vintage films, and they did an Apes Day, and they ran all 5 Apes films back to back to back to back to back, which was quite a marathon experience. And seeing them all in one shot, You know, it's I never realized before, but that Beneath Planet of the Apes is not a good movie. It really is. It's a collection of sci-fi ideas that they just sort of put in a bag and shook, hoping, I think, that they could cover up for the fact that you couldn't shock the audience the way you did in the first one. So they just put in a jumble of things. They got mutants, they got the bomb, they got the apes, they've got Taylor going into the sort of like nether region, and then you've got the new astronaut, Brent. You know, I mean, it's like, and none of it all hangs together. It's all just random. I mean, Beneath is fun. It's a really, to me, and in some ways, it's almost the most fun of the five movies because it's just got so much crazy stuff in it.
Right.
But it's a genre movie as opposed to the first film, which is a bona fide classic. You know, to me, Planet of the Apes is one of the great sci-fi movies of all time, and I would put it on any list of like the great 250 movies ever made.
Definitely.
You know, but Beneath or any of the other ones just don't hold up to that. This is just more of a genre exercise, but it's a fun genre exercise. I mean, just the idea of, you know, this race of people that worship a bomb, and it's set in New York. You know, it's just got a ton of fun, crazy ideas just all sort of thrown together. And one of the things that, again, Scott, I don't know how you feel, but one of the things that, like, you know, in the movie, you've got James Franciscus as Brent.
Right.
Brent, who is, you know, kind of a Charlton Heston light version. And to me, he can't fill the space the way Charlton Heston does. Charlton Heston is one of the, you know, the great movie stars of all time. James Franciscus is kind of like, you know, I think the C-level version of that guy. But in the comic book, you don't have that. So Brent, to me, fills the space just fine. Because
right.
It's just a comic book. He's not competing against Charlton Heston. He's just competing against Taylor, who is just another comic book character.
Well, the fight between the two characters, which is one of the you know, that's one of the classic moments of that movie, is this epic knockdown, drag out, bare knuckle fist fight between Taylor and Brent in the film, completely excised from this. We do get a little moment where they're both kind of mind whammied by the mutants, but that's about it. We don't get the fight between the two of them. The thing that really cracks me up with this is, again, you're getting you know, an extreme condensing of the story. A lot of stuff is left out in the need to tell it within just a few pages. But the great part that is radically different is it comes at the very end of the adaptation, where you have Taylor run out and try to stop the gorillas from what they're doing. They just gun him down, although you really don't see it. You just see the gorillas fire, but you don't really see Taylor being hit. But it's pretty easy to guess that he has been gunned down. And it is actually one of the mutants that sets off the bomb, not Taylor.
Despite the cover, despite what you're seeing on the cover.
Right, yeah, exactly. And I love the last page. The very last page is great because it reminds me very strongly of any time you would see the destruction of Krypton depicted in Superman comics.
Yeah.
It looks very much like that, especially the top panel is it almost looks like kryptonite. You know, these giant green chunks of rock, you know, upheaving and everything. And then the next panel is the Earth actually exploding, very Krypton-like. I like that quite a bit. I like the art on that page
That's
in a way that I don't really care for the art in the rest of the book.
Yeah, there are some nice moments here. I mean, like the scene with General Ursus, where he's speaking to the apes crowd and he's trying to rile them up. That is like, kind of spooky because it's done in these sort of dark, heavy colors of like heavy purple and blue. And it looks like it takes place at night and they're yelling General Ursus over and over again. And it's not done as word balloons. It's floating. The words General Ursus are floating in the air.
Right.
Like it's a chant, which is scary. You know what I mean? And I think it's conveyed very well of how frightening it would be to be a human on this planet and watch these apes, you know, first of all, you know, you're not the superior race on this planet, but to see this race of people that are now militarized and talking about naked, merciless force, you know, that's pretty scary. And it's conveyed well here. It looks like it's the same artwork from Planet of the Apes. So I'm going to assume it's, again, it's Ernie Chan or Ernie Chua. And I think you're right about Nestor Redondo. It looks like his inks to me. So it's nice that they got this the same art team. It gives it a nice consistent feel across the board.
Yeah, definitely.
As we mentioned, the story ends with the Earth blowing up. Captions say, and in the Doomsday chain reaction, so also is the planet called Earth. And now we have too seen the future. Must it be our future? Now that we know, can we make it sure it will not be? Which is a much more upbeat ending, as much as you can have, where the world ends, than it
That's
is. That's
a lot of pressure to put on little kids, though. You know,
you kids out there playing with your stupid toys, you got to make sure the world doesn't blow up when you become adults. I wasn't ready for that kind of pressure. Just give me a lightsaber. That's all I really cared about. The movie ends with literally just the world has ended. The end. Leave the theater. You know, like pick up your milk duds and go home. So they at least tried to give it a little more of an upbeat ending here. But it's still, you can only do so much when you're blowing up the entire planet. So that's Beneath Planet of the Apes. That's the first two of these great Power Records adventures. Before we say goodbye to Scott, I want to ask you, Scott, as we talked about, Dawn of Planet of the Apes is coming out just a couple of days from when this episode drops. How much did you like, or where did you like it all, Rise of the Planet of the Apes? What did you think of that?
Loved it. Absolutely loved it. We just did a commentary for it over on Two True Freaks. So any of your listeners that might be interested in that, check that out. But it is essentially us talking over the movie for however long the movie runs, and just repeatedly gushing about it because we both really, really liked the movie quite a bit. But yeah, I went to it when it came out. I think I went to the premiere, if I'm not mistaken, and I went in cautiously optimistic, but not really expecting anything great, because at that time it just felt like maybe Apes had kind of played out a little bit, but was completely blown away by it in a good way, and really looking forward to Dawn. I can't wait for that movie to come out. I'm hoping that it carries the quality and the level forward again to another good movie, because, I was quite impressed with Rise.
Yeah, me too.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, after the Burton one, I was sort of like, okay, but I really did like Rise quite a bit myself, and all the things I'm hearing about Dawn is really good. I've heard really, really good things about it. So, I'm excited for it too. So, excellent, very cool. The apes are alive and well. There's the comic book series now. Who does the comic book series? Is it Boom Studios that has the current apes franchise?
I know they were doing it. I don't know if they're doing anything at the moment. My understanding was Cataclysm was the last thing that they were doing, and that wrapped up with number 12. I want to say it's been at least a year, but I'll be honest, I am not really keeping up with modern comics much these days, so they may be putting out some new stuff in conjunction with the new film coming out. I don't know. I'd really have to look into that to find out. But they are the most recent publishing house to have the license, and I thought they were really doing some solid stuff. We did a little examination of them on Back to the Bins on our fourth week, because we kind of went in order. Week one was the Marvel stuff, and then week two was the old Adventure Comic stuff from the 90s. Week three, we took a look at it was a Canadian imprint called Mr. Comics that, so far as we could determine, only ever published one thing, which was a 6-issue miniseries that was set between Conquest and Battle. And then Boom Studios is the most recent one to have the license, and most of their stuff was phenomenal. I really, really dug the Boom stuff quite a bit. Especially they had two mini series and then a maxi series that kind of built on each other, and it was in a more familiar Apes world because it was set just about 20 years before the classic movie. So you had like Dr. Zaius was in it and Cornelius and, more familiar characters to us. So it wasn't just a bunch of made up characters.
Right. I remember being impressed that a lot. One of the series I saw had artwork by a guy named Gabriel Hardman, who was good and like a perfect fit.
Yeah.
His style was perfect fit. Like it reminded me kind of not that it looks the same, but it reminded me Marvel like had, I remember Alfredo Acala do a lot of their stuff. And his style is sort of perfect for apes, that milieu. And I feel like Hardman is the perfect guy for that. I'm like, oh, they found a really good guy. You know, they found like a really appropriate art style for this Apes comic. So, yeah, as I said, the apes are alive and well. So, well, anyway, Scott, thank you so much for joining me on the show. I hope you had a good time talking to some apes.
Absolutely.
Where can people find you on the internet and give me, let's say, only 5 of the 15 podcasts that you host?
Well, you can find everything that I do is all on one convenient feed over at we actually have our own website. It's 2TrueFreaks.com. We have tons and tons and tons of shows over there. I don't participate in every one of them, but the main ones that I participate in are, of course, the 2 True Freaks proper shows, which we do a monthly Star Wars show, a monthly Star Trek show, a monthly comic book show. And then for the time being, we do a monthly commentary show. But we're in the process of kind of rethinking and reimagining the show. So we're going to be dropping some things, adding some things. It's going to be really exciting. Come August and September, we're kind of going through a restructuring, so that's going to be a lot of fun. Other shows I participate in, we have Back to the Bins, which again, it's a random comic book talk all about back issues and such. And then Michael Bailey and I and you know, folks that listen to You and Shag may be familiar with Michael Bailey because, you know, Shag used to be the semi-regular co-host on one of Mike's shows. Michael Bailey and I, we do Tales of the Justice Society of America together, and that that show's an absolute blast.
I love that show.
Those are some of the places where you can find me around the internet.
Very cool. Very cool. So, again, thank you for coming on. This has been a blast because I'm looking at this planet blow up. It feels inappropriate. So, anyway, thank you so much, Scott, for being on the show. I really appreciate it. And hold on, folks. We are going to come back with part 2 with my regular co-host, Earth 2 Chris. In the meantime, enjoy the semi-depressing Mego Planet of the Apes toy commercials. Featuring some kind of bizarre ad copy, considering you were trying to sell dolls to children. So anyway, enjoy these, and thanks. Scott, thanks for doing the show.
Hey, thank you.
Mego presents the Planet of the Apes action figures. Dr. Zaius, the orangutan scientist. Cornelius, the archaeologist. Zira, the woman scientist. The soldier ape. And the astronaut. All Planet of the Apes action figures sold separately by Mego.
Where am I?
I smell an astronaut.
I wonder what's over the hill.
Set the trap.
What's that?
We'll get him now.
What is this place?
Spring the trap. Into the jail with him.
I must plan an escape.
He'll never escape.
Planet of the Apes Forbidden Zone Trap. Figure sold separately by Mego.
And we're back for part 2 of this special double-length Power Records podcast episode. And joining me here for the second part of the other 2 Apes movie adaptations is my regular co-host, Earth 2 Chris. Chris, great to have you back.
Hey, Rob. Great to be back.
All right, awesome. Before we get into the escape from Planet of the Apes, are you, I asked Scott this earlier, are you a particular apes fan? And if so, like, how did you get started with them?
Well, I'm going to endanger the possession of my nerd card here. I am not actually a big Planet of the Apes fan. I know it's shocking. And obviously there's people that are a lot younger than me that are into Planet of the Apes, but I think of our age group, I was just right under the deadline of when it was super big, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it was omnipresent. I was just born just right after, or was aware right after it had kind of started to die down, and I think that's part of it. I remember watching the movies on TV when I was a kid. I have seen the original movie, you know, as an adult and watched it and enjoyed it. But as far as the sequels, I haven't, other than seeing bits and pieces here and there, I haven't really, you know, gone back and watched them again as an adult. I need to rectify that situation, I know.
Wow, yeah, so these adaptations are like your idea of what these movies are.
Well, you know, they kind of bring up memories of them while I was listening to them and looking at the comics the comic pages. They kind of, you know, brought up vague memories of them. But yeah, it's kind of, I'm just basically looking at them from the Power Records perspective almost. So maybe that'll be a kind of good counterpoint to Scott, because yeah. I know he's a big Planet of the Apes fan.
So you didn't have these records as a kid, right?
No, I didn't have these. I had a lot of the superheroes and the Star Trek. But as much as I had Mego figures, superheroes and Happy Days and Dukes of Hazzard and Star Trek, I didn't have any Planet of the Apes Migos either. So
it would have been great to mix Planet of the Apes and Happy Days. That would have been awesome.
If they could have figured out a way to do it, they probably would have.
I'm sure the Apes series would have just been diminished further into Cornelius and Zira going back to 1950s Milwaukee. I'm sure if they could have done it, they would have.
They're hiding out in Richie's room.
Yeah, there you go.
Howard Cunningham's beating on the door. I can see it now.
Hey, there's apes here.
Yeah.
So without further ado, we will get right to Escape from Planet of the Apes. This is the third film in the series and the third Power Records adaptation. As we mentioned in the first segment, you know, each successive Apes film ends in a darker and darker place. Yeah. But we will talk about all that on the other side of it. So for now, enjoy Escape from the Planet of the Apes.
Escape from the Planet of the Apes. In the year 3955, the world comes to a fiery end. This isn't prophecy. It is actually being witnessed by Earth's last two living beings.
The fools have done it. Look, the rim of the Earth is melting.
Then why did we escape? Where do we go?
Perhaps nowhere. Hold tight. Shockwave!
The vibration. I'm blacking out.
Just as well. The instruments are going haywire. I don't know how long the ship will hold together.
Its occupants unconscious, the spaceship becomes a ball of fire as it enters a dense atmosphere and splashes down into a tranquil blue sea.
Are we all right?
That remains to be seen.
Yes, Mr. President. A Marine copter reported a spacecraft in the water off the California coast, but we had no spacecraft up.
Jim, we've checked the markings. Hold on to your seat. It might be Taylor's ship.
Have you heard?
This might be Taylor's ship. But that was lost in space over a year ago. Nobody can be alive inside.
I hear voices. They speak our language. They must be intelligent.
Perhaps, but do not speak till we've appraised the situation.
Someone is moving. Wait, there are two. Step back. Don't touch them. Chimps.
Humans. I hope you're satisfied, Cornelius. I pretended to be mute as you instructed. And what do we get for our trouble? We end up in a cage.
They call this a marine guardhouse.
Bars make it a cage. We caged enough humans, didn't we? Oh, Cornelius, we are in danger, aren't we?
Yes, dear. Remember how Taylor was treated when he tried to convince us that he was intelligent and had come from space? Now we are in Taylor's position.
Our apenauts are to be transferred to the zoo.
Distinguished visitors for the monkey house, huh?
Here, humans rule and apes are primitive. Do not upset them, Zira. Not only for our sake.
Someone's coming.
Shortly afterward, at the Los Angeles Zoo.
I'm looking forward to testing these space apes, Stevie.
They're probably quite intelligent, Lewis, but they're not the first primates to have been sent into orbit.
These two are different. I'm told that at the guardhouse they changed their clothes from a suitcase.
I don't believe it.
I'm Dr. Dixon, here to examine the new arrivals.
Yes, sir. Careful with the female. She's sulky.
You'd sulk, too, if you had to sit and be tickled under the chin and pretend to be a lower-order animal.
Hello, big fellas. We're going to be friends. Look, banana.
Maybe they don't grow bananas in space, Lewis.
Mmm, yummy yum.
I detest bananas, young man.
What's going on with these monkeys we're supposed to be guarding?
Chimps, pal, and you wouldn't believe it. First that zoologist and his assistant go into the cage, and then they send me for tea. Then they tell me to get lost.
So, what's wrong with the zoologist liking tea?
Nothing, except when you sit down to drink it with a couple of apes whose manners are fancier than yours.
This is the most exciting moment of my entire career.
That's the way we felt when we met your astronaut, Taylor, so long ago, or should I say, so far ahead in the future.
Then you're convinced you have come from the future? From this very same planet? And actually witnessed the destruction of Earth?
I am convinced, sorrowfully.
Very well, Dr. Haslein, you're my scientific advisor. Form an investigating committee if you think it necessary.
It is necessary. The ship is Taylor's. The time meter read 3955 AD. The implications are staggering, Mr. President. Dr. Haslein is efficient. The usual red tape is cut, and in a very short time, Zira and Cornelius find themselves being whisked toward Los Angeles.
Whee! What luxury!
Where they soon cause consternation amid a distinguished presidential committee.
I cannot believe what I hear. You say you come from the future, and that in the future here on Earth, apes will rule, and men will be lower order animals? How can that happen?
I'm not quite certain myself, sir, but when astronaut Taylor found his way to us through a time warp in space, he deduced that man had destroyed his civilization through nuclear war. Not many years from now, I would guess.
Dr. Haslein, do you believe this nonsense?
There is no other explanation, Senator.
Coolly, Zira and Cornelius complete their testimony in the stunned silence of the great room.
Evidently, civilized men, warlike men, had managed to survive your nuclear war. They lived beneath a molten city. When the guerrillas marched against them, much against our will, they destroyed the Earth.
Our scientists had managed to make Taylor's ship operable. Poorly skilled as we were, we had to chance flying into space for safety, for the sake of...
We were in space.
We saw the explosion. We saw the rim of the Earth melt.
You were magnificent.
They will not let us live, Lewis.
But perhaps our baby will.
Perhaps fate has chosen to send two apes back through a time warp to warn us. Somehow, man will make a fatal mistake and allow apes to take over. But we will not help that mistake to happen. These talking apes will be confined for life. I'm sending them to Camp 11, and their offspring will be taken away.
Haslein's decision was cruel. Zira and Cornelius committed no crime.
But Haslein feels their descendants will. No descendants, no crime. But at least they're safe and comfortable, and perhaps in time.
Cornelius, my baby must not be born in imprisonment.
I agree, Zira, dear. This door was designed to hold humans.
Where do you think you're going, monkey?
Don't touch her! I didn't hit him hard, but now, just as our people hunted Taylor, his people will hunt us.
The chimps have escaped! They killed Turner!
We've got to find them, Stevie, and we mustn't be seen.
So much for a nice, quiet visit. I am sorry to slow us down.
I would rather have the baby born right here than in there.
Oh, Zira, it's all right. It's us, Stevie and Lewis. You'll be all right. There's time. We're taking you to a friend who has a circus. I've done veterinary work for... Oh, sorry.
You forget. I was a veterinarian myself, for humans.
You ask me to risk everything for two fugitive apes? I would be insulted if you asked anyone else.
Between the tiger cage and the chimpanzees, how do you like your room?
Lovely.
You helped deliver our last baby, Stevie, and now you do it again. Say hello to Eloise and your goddaughter Salome.
Hello, baby. Soon you'll have company.
I just phoned in to say I was searching. Haslein is scouring the area. Is that...
our baby.
A boy.
May I suggest a name? In consideration of the worlds he must conquer, Caesar.
Baby Caesar.
And the St. Francis Medal, for good fortune.
I never meant to hit the guard so hard. I didn't realize my strength. Perhaps Haslein is right. Maybe we can never live together.
With understanding, we come to know one another's strength, and our own.
Meanwhile, Haslein musters all his strength.
They can't get out of the city limits. Now finecomb every likely place for an ape to hide. Every zoo, every circus.
Rotten, rotten luck. Luz, we must hide them. Haslein's men are heading here. Where can they go?
I know a place.
In 2 weeks, I break camp and go to Florida. They will be safe there for life.
Zira?
Coming. I'm saying goodbye to Heloise. We have become such good friends.
Beyond this abandoned shipyard is a small harbor I used to play in. There is a derelict ship you can hide in for 2 weeks. We'll come for you when it's safe. Then on to Florida.
I hate this place. It smells of men and death. We won't need this again.
If he had seen us, would I have had to kill again? If it weren't for the child, I don't think I could go on. But the child must live. He must.
Yes, Cornelius. He must.
You have papers for these chimps?
Of course. The little one was the first baby chimp ever born in a circus in the Los Angeles area. Her name is Salome, and...
it's clean. Let's go.
I'm warning you, Dixon. Don't play games with me. If you know where those chimps are, I'll have your hide.
Look what turned up, Dr. Haslein.
Lewis, what happened?
It sounds like they found Zira's suitcase. We've got to get out there.
Move it. You'll never know how important this is. Get choppers out to the old McKinley shipyard. Surround the yard and the harbor.
Unaware of the forces racing toward them, Zira and Cornelius try to settle in.
2 weeks here? It's so filthy.
Try to rest. I'll look for something better above.
Let me out here.
It's a bad pun, but he's gone bananas.
I've got them. Do it yourself and do it right. No do-gooders, no philosophers. No one seems to realize what hangs in the balance.
He's flipped for sure.
Well, I'm not going to stop him. These big shots can be murder.
With fanatical stealth, Haslein boards the derelict.
Cornelius, where are you?
Why, thank you, Madam Monkey. If they know we're here, there's nothing I can do. Why did I take this? What could ever induce me to use it?
I'll take the baby, Zira.
Zira!
Come back, Zira. Come back with that baby.
An armed invasion for two harmless apes?
Never mind the army. Where's Haslein?
Haslein is fulfilling his destiny.
Zira! Zira!
Wait! Don't fire!
I have changed man's fate, Dixon.
Have you, Haslein? Have you?
Get ready to move out. How you doing, little fellow?
Mama. Mama.
From out of the future to lead your fellow creatures into the future. Caesar, indeed.
Mama. Mama.
And we're back, and as I mentioned, each successive Apes film ends in a darker spot than the previous one did. The first film, of course, ends with Statue of Liberty. Second one ends with the Planet of the Apes being destroyed. And the third film ends with our sweet, harmless ape characters, our ape protagonists, Zira and Cornelius, being shot to death.
Jeez.
In front of their baby. So that's Escape from the Planet of the Apes. Chris, what did you think of it?
Well, you know... overall, just, I mean, like, again, I'm kind of going by just the power records. Of course, I can kind of under, being you know, aware of comic adaptations, movie adaptations into comics and other things like that. I kind of understand they have to, you know, cut whole parts out and they can't adapt every second of the film, but there is some huge shifts in tone in this, this thing, man. I mean, you know, you start out with the destruction of Earth, which in the comic looks like a like some strange Ditko-esque realm from a Doctor Strange comic, and then, you know, then you're getting the cute scenes with the guy, you know, wanting them to, you know, oh, eat a banana, and you know, oh, it's, I detest bananas, and cute little scenes like that, and then, you know, then of course you end with, you know, the very peaceful apes characters, like you said, getting just gunned down on a kid's record, you know. So wow.
Yeah, it's almost like they didn't, who making these apes movies, they didn't really think of these as children's films. And they weren't. I mean, the first Planet of the Apes movie is not a children's film. It's a science fiction film. It's not a children's film. But yeah. It's like, I think people that didn't pay attention were like, oh, it's science fiction and it's guys in monkey costumes. That must be a means for kids.
Right.
And it's like, but yet you've got somebody murdering the two apes characters in a children's record. I mean, just like.
Yeah. You know, you would think maybe it might have been a better idea to just come up with new stories within the Planet of the Apes universe that weren't maybe as violent and as depressing.
Well, that's funny you say that because, you know, I didn't mention this in the part with Scott, but there are other power records about the Planet of the Apes, and that they are original stories. Mm. Now, they are the only like comic book-y or movie related power records that I don't own. I just never got them. I've seen them on eBay here and there, and I just never picked them up. But I want to because now I'm really curious. Like, what are these other adventures? They put them out in not book and records forms, but in 45s and LPs. And it's four new adventures. I think they all take place like on the Planet of the Apes. So they must take place somewhere around like beneath Planet of the Apes. But yeah, so the writers were capable of this. These were obviously meant to be specifically adaptations. But yeah, you're right. It's like you really think they would have said, let's move. Maybe we shouldn't stick with this story if they're going to keep doing this.
Well, I guess they saw, you know, Mego's making action figures and there's all these other kid-centric things. So, hey, why not? You know, I mean, it's really kind of a strange that this, I guess, you guys have probably talked about this already, but I guess it took off with the merchandising when the original movie was shown on TV, right? So,
right.
It went over big with kids. So that's why you saw this kid merchandise, but it's kind of strange that they even marketed it toward kids, you know, and you know, at the end of the decade, there was a big fervor over them marketing the Alien to kids and toys didn't make it out and stuff. So it's interesting to see that earlier in the decade, especially considering that on Saturday morning TV, the Super Friends couldn't even throw a punch.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
But in your kids' records, they can have, you know, peaceful creatures getting shot down, you know, just mercilessly. So it's very, very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And it looks like it's the art style wise in terms of the book part of the book and record set. It looks like it's the same artist from the previous two, which to me is Ernie Chan or Ernie Chua slash with Nestor Redondo. It looks, has that look to it, which is, I mean, these guys had like a realistic style, which to me kind of makes the violence seem that much more worse. If they had gotten maybe a more cartoony guy, it might not have been as intense, but it's, you know, it's just really pretty nasty.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has that Filipino art style that was in Marvel and DC a lot at the time. And yeah, like you said, if they had Joe Giella or somebody draw it, you know, it probably phased you as bad. But yeah, it makes it that much more gruesome, for lack of a better term, you know. But you know, I thought overall, the, you know, having not watched the movie and since I was a kid, you know, I can't really go by how the character voices, you know, match the actors, but I felt like that the actors, you know, did a pretty good job, especially with the story bouncing around like it did and the tonal changes. It was engaging. It was kind of a emotional roller coaster for about a 10-minute break.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. The voice of Hasseline, who is the main guy who wants to kill the apes, in the movie, he's English. He's an English guy. And then here they change him to German, which I always like the de facto evil guy voice. You know, I want to kid the apes. You know, they always make this guy. So they made that change. They felt, you know, okay, we got to – and he doesn't look anything like the actor. So they felt free enough to go off from that. In fact, none of them look like the actors. I don't know whether likeness rights was a thing in 1974, but like – you know, the guy running the circus is Ricardo Montalban in the movie. And in here, he looks absolutely nothing like Ricardo Montalban.
Right,
so,
right.
I don't know whether that was just the artist didn't bother. You know, I mean, I'm sure it was probably a lot harder to get photo reference back then. It wasn't like you could just Google it. Or it was particularly a licensing thing where, you know, no, it's got to look like different people or something. I don't know.
Could be the same reason why Uhura is white in the Power Records.
Could be that they just didn't care, more likely.
You know, it's kind of funny. One thing I did, and one thing just from going from the record, it seems interesting. You know, Haslin's the villain, but they give him a line where he says, you know, basically nobody's listening to me. They don't understand how big this is. You know, and you. They kind of shade him in a little bit. He's not exactly just evil, you know. He thinks he's doing the right thing.
Right. He thinks he's saving the world. Right.
Yeah, he thinks he's saving the world, and it's kind of funny because the humans that are helping Cornelius and Zira, they're kind of like, oh, your kid's going to conquer the world. Ah, we'll give you a place to stay. it's really kind of strange. It's just like, oh, we're. It's our fate for you guys to take over and the world to blow up. You know, it's just, I mean, it's just listening to it in a 10-minute record, you're just kind of like,
It was the 70s, Chris. You know, people had a very cynical attitude. Oh, what the hell? Yeah. Nixon's president. What the hell? Who is the difference does it make? Things are already bad enough. So, you know, it's a fun record, you know, it's a fun adventure. These are fairly well produced. I love some of the jokes that they stick in, which, you know, like there's the joke about the near the end or where things are getting really hot and heavy. There's the one guard and he makes a joke about bananas and he says, he's like, not funny, but you know, like he even points out that it's a horrible joke. You're like,
yeah. Bad pun, but he's going bananas.
That's right. Yeah, he's going bananas. It's like, who added that? And it reminds me, there's a gag in Beneath the Planet of the Apes, which I did mention at the time when I was talking to Scott. But there's where he is, Brent is riding with Nova. And he says something to Nova like, you don't talk much, do you? That's funny, because back on our world, the women won't ever shut up. And he's like, oh my God. Misogyny of the Planet of the Apes. You know?
that was the sixth movie that never came.
Yeah, exactly. You know, good Lord. So is there anything else do we want to talk about for Escape, or should we move on?
It was very engaging, like I said, maybe because of it couldn't help itself adapting this movie, but just in the little increments of the sections of the story, it just bounced from, you know, just funny, apes, talking apes on in modern day Earth to, you know, cold blooded murder. So, you know, just a strange one.
Yeah, very odd. So, all right, well, so that was Escape from the Planet of the Apes. So now we're going to listen to Battle for the Planet of the Apes, and we will explain why we are jumping one apes film when we get back. So enjoy this Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
Battle for the Planet of the Apes. The year is 2670 AD. The place, North America. In a ceremonial setting, an ancient lawgiver begins to read.
In the beginning, man and beast dwelt in peace. In time, evil men waged war both against their own kind and the apes, whom they placed in slavery. Then a leader appeared to deliver his fellow apes to freedom. Man, in the vilest of all wars, destroyed his own cities and his civilization. The leader lived through the Holocaust, along with a precious handful of survivors. He brought them out of the molten city to greener pastures, where ape and human could learn to live in harmony. His name was Caesar, and this is his story.
Caesar, in a few short years, you have carved a paradise out of the wilderness.
Paradise? That would mean happiness for all, would it not? McDonald has ape privileges, but there's no equality for us.
Maybe you're not old enough to remember how humans used to treat the apes.
I sense restlessness and discontent among the humans, and the gorillas have no liking for peace and order.
Look out, Caesar!
Hail, mighty Caesar!
General Aldo may be riding for a fall.
Before he causes Ape City to fall, I hope.
Aldo and his followers do pose a problem. Ah, Lisa, dear. McDonald will be having lunch with us.
He knows he is always welcome.
Aldo misses the excitement of the old days when we were fighting for our freedom. But how does one control a 400-pound gorilla?
You have the power. The gorillas are armed with swords. Your armory contains real weapons.
No! No! You think the unthinkable. You know our primal commandment. Ape shall not kill ape.
I know. Does Aldo?
Forgive me, dear friend. The burdens of leadership are heavy. If only I could see what lies ahead. I've heard that my parents knew the future. Did you ever hear that?
Your parents are half legend and half myth, Caesar. I've heard that they came from the future in a spaceship that passed through a time warp in space and landed in California back in 1973.
And that men, civilized men, were so frightened by talking apes that they murdered them.
Easy, Caesar. We've all paid for our folly.
Again, forgive my emotions. I never really saw my parents. They were slain when I was a baby.
You mean you never saw the videotapes of their interview after they landed? They were in the archives in the Forbidden City.
McDonald! Could the tapes still exist?
You can't be thinking of searching for them. You yourself declared it a forbidden city, Caesar.
At dawn, three figures pass a gorilla lookout post on the road out of Ape City.
General Aldo, look. They're going toward Forbidden City.
It's Caesar himself breaking Caesar's rule. I hope he never makes it back. Look at those guns. They make my mouth water.
Caesar, when you move, you move. You've commandeered weapons and a Geiger counter from the armory, and Professor Virgil from his classroom. And we're 2 days into the desert before my eyes are fully open.
Virgil's students need a rest from his fancy theories. He teaches that time is a circle and eternity a straight line, and their brains turn to lead. What we need is practical knowledge of radiation and Geiger counters.
The Geiger speaks to us all. We're getting close.
From a rise, the traveler's gaze transfixed at a city crumpled and melted by an inferno into a glassy slag heap. War!
Unbelievable and almost beautiful.
If death is beautiful. Find your subterranean vault quickly, McDonald. This radiation is deadly.
Hurry, tell Cope.
It's like a catacomb.
But it's cleaner. We have time to look. Governor Kelp, intruders!
Ah, there they are. The scanning devices are still operative. So, Mendez, you thought me mad to maintain wartime vigilance.
Three lost strangers don't make a war.
You don't recognize the chimp? That's Caesar, the leader of the blasted ape insurrection. He's come back to finish the job. But I'll finish him. Battle stations! Battle stations! Seize invaders in archive section!
I think we've found it.
Is that my mother?
You look like her.
We saw the guerrillas' war from space. We saw a blinding white light. The Earth's surface began to melt. The date meter in our spaceship read 3950.
Destruction of our planet. That is our future. How dare you theorize about eternity?
That is only one future. Time is like a many-lane highway from the past to the future. A car in lane A may crash while a car in lane B travels on. It follows that you can switch lanes and survive. Find the correct lane, Caesar, and lead your civilization to safety.
Switch lanes? That makes the burden of leadership unbearable.
Surrender or die!
Caesar explodes out of despair and into decisive action.
Out the other way!
Observe the difference between philosopher and born leader. The latter switches lanes by reflex.
This way! Through here!
They got away. How?
They were too strong for us. They were healthy.
Send out trackers. Find their headquarters. Mobilize for total war. An exhausting double-time race across the desert brings Caesar and his companions close to home.
Caesar, you were magnificent.
We've done nothing. Our real work lies ahead.
Halt! Who goes there?
You know who I am, fool. Be at the schoolhouse tomorrow morning for an emergency council meeting.
Something tells me our chance may have come.
Governor Culp, we have tracked the invaders to an ape city to the north.
Ha! With surprise on our side, this is our chance. An army that would be pathetic were it not for its deadly intent sets out across the desert. At an emergency council meeting, Caesar sums up his disastrous trip.
And so because the dead city turns out not to be dead, and because of the deranged condition of the survivors there, we must consider preparations for war.
No!
No! No!
No!
No!
No!
I regret this more than you, but we must plan.
Bah! Planners, talkers, cowards! I welcome war, and I will not sit in council with a human.
Perhaps I shouldn't be here.
Nonsense, Aldo Bluffs. I need you, MacDonald. I rely on you. I trust you.
Through the long day and into the night, Caesar and his council draw up plans.
We must erect barricades, stock food in the center of the city, create a militia, and most important, set up plans for the quick distribution of arms from the armory effort.
While General Aldo sets his own plans in action.
Group A, you know what to do. The rest of you, on to the armory.
And Culp's army reaches the outskirts of Ape City.
Look at that food!
Why have we been scavenging all these years?
Caesar, Caesar! Aldo has looted the armory and has rounded up all the humans and imprisoned them in the stockade.
He dared?
Well, we worked through the night.
Caesar, a strange army is encamped in the orchards. They have shot the guerrilla outpost.
My faulty leadership. I underestimated Aldo's recklessness and Culp's madness. Barricade the street. Perhaps Aldo can hold the mutants long enough for us to organize.
I must free my people. They'll be slaughtered, penned up.
What's this human piggy doing out of his pen?
Idiots. What are you doing here with an enemy army at the city gates?
You call those human runts an army? As soon as General Aldo finishes them off, he'll come for you. So don't get too comfy. No more humans in our new world.
These rifles are great, General, but we haven't had any instructions.
They're automatic. Even a dumb gorilla can...
Here they come. Imagine sending monkeys to fight a man's war. The gorillas gallop into a semicircle of carnage. Now!
Regroup! Follow me!
Victory!
City, the city is ours!
They're coming! Get ready!
Now, I want Caesar! Culp possesses the one major weapon of the battle. And it opens the city like a cannon.
Can this be Caesar? Remember this?
Does it remind you of the good old days when apes knew who their masters were? The wrong words. Charging from the rear, Aldo and his troops cut down the panicked invaders to the last mutant, Culp.
I claim victory and full command. Now for the other human swine in the stockade.
No!
You say no? You sniveling talker, you say no to Aldo?
Aldo, respect.
Respect me!
Ape shall not kill ape!
Too late. You should have told me sooner, but it didn't hurt a bit. Shall we try again?
Storytellers will swear from generation to generation that living fire leaped from Caesar's eyes.
Aldo will kill him!
Never in a million light years!
Caesar's rage is like nature unleashed. Aldo flees to the trees in vain. In the dead silence, the branches snap like pistol shots, and the gorilla lands like a boulder that has never known life.
The lane you had to choose, Caesar.
Caesar, forgive me for saying this. Do not release us if it's going to be the same as it's always been. If we humans can't come out as equals, to work and live alongside you in our own way, together, then we'd just as soon stay penned up.
I never considered anything else, at least not since I fell out of the tree. We need one another if there's to be a future for this planet. We must watch together for whatever evil might come crawling out of the haunted, forbidden cities of our world.
The lawgiver finishes his narrative. Twilight rests softly on the rapt faces of his young listeners.
And so we have lived together now for generations. Men and apes as equals.
watchfully guarding our future.
Lawgiver, does anyone really know the future?
Perhaps only the dead, child.
Is it the evening dew glistening in Caesar's stone eye?
And with the crying Caesar statue, that is the end of Battle for the Planet of the Apes, which is the final Power Records Apes adaptation, and also the final Apes film, of course, until the Tim Burton reboot, which we will not discuss here, or ever. Now, for those of you that are Apes fans, you're wondering, where did Conquest of the Planet of the Apes go? Why is there Chapter 4 missing from this series? You know, as I've mentioned before, I don't have any really inside information about these records because there is no information to be had, or at least I've not been able to find any. My hunch is that Conquest, of all the films, was the one that had the most problem with the rating in terms of the on-screen violence. I mean, that film is about a militant call for revolution. In fact, at the end of that film where Caesar... tells the apes, you know, we are now living on the Planet of the Apes, Roddy McDowall had to go back in post-production and re-record his speech because the original version was deemed so militant and so violent that they felt it went too far for a children's film. So if you go back and watch that scene, you will see that there are a bunch of cutaways to just Caesar's eyes. And all of a sudden, the soundtrack sounds a little different, and that's because they redubbed it later. And they didn't have any footage to cover it because you could see he looks super angry. They realized, that Battle for the Planet of the Apes is still rated G, which is unbelievable. You got people being gunned down, and there's the plague that killed the dogs and the cats and all this stuff. My hunch is that they just realized there was no way to make that a children's record. It just went too far, even for Power Records. Even maybe if it had a suicidal clown in it, I don't know, they would have deemed it acceptable. But I guess they figured, let's just skip over it. Nobody will know the difference, and we'll just move on to the final film. So I would love to find out if I'm right about that, and maybe someday if everybody will Kickstarter my Power Records book idea, I'll find out. But until then, that is my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Sounds feasible.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds plausible considering that what trouble that film had. I mean, in the documentary behind The Planet of the Apes, they talk about doing a preview for that film, like in Inglewood, and it was for like a predominantly African American audience, and they said people went nuts because they took it as a revolution movie, and they said the studio was like, you know, that's not what we wanted to make. We thought we were making a kids movie about apes, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm going to bet that this just, you know, Power Records just thought, no, too much. So anyway, Battle for the Planet of the Apes, the final installment. Chris, what did you think?
I really enjoyed this one. I think the tone in this one was more consistent. You didn't get that jarring, you know, back and forth. This was pretty dour from the beginning, so you didn't have all that cute little scenes and then bloodshed and things like that. It was pretty straight up. You knew the situation you were in from the beginning, and I thought it was well done. Just going by the record, I thought it was well done. I do think they really wanted you to know the commandment about ape not killing ape.
Yeah.
Let's overemphasize this, but. Other than that, I thought it held together really well.
Yeah, I mean, they did a pretty good job. I think this is a pretty well done story because as an Apes fan, I have to admit, Battle for the Planet of the Apes is a terrible movie. It's a terrible movie. They in this documentary that I saw, they talk about how they kept cutting the budget for each successive Apes film. And the fifth film looks really cheap, and there is a battle between humans and apes for no reason. There just is no reason for them to battle other than the script needs them to fight one more time. So it is. They were really running on fumes at this point. And to my mind, the film series should have ended with Conquest of the Apes, with the apes taking over. That would have been a great way to say, we are now at the Planet of the Apes. You know, we've circled around, and now the apes have taken over. This fifth film just feels like not a waste, but just they had no idea what to do with it. And so the Power Records guys must have really been sort of stuck because it's a turkey of a movie. And then, like I said, I think this adaptation actually works pretty well. I don't know if I can say it's like, quote unquote, better than the movie, but in a lot of ways I think it is more effective, I think, because because of its brevity, it papers over a lot of the really bad stuff in the movie. I mean, the movie is 95 minutes, and there are parts of it where you're just like, what is going on here? What, you know, they're passing off, a basement of a warehouse somewhere as like some futuristic, you know, you're like, no, this is the Power Record just shoots by so fast that you don't have time to really gloss over the really bizarre and weak elements.
Well, it sounds almost like that this could be – it's somewhat like the comic adaptation of Superman 4, The Quest for Peace.
Yeah.
Which everyone holds up much higher than the film itself.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's true. There's a great podcast in that, in adaptations of bad movies, comic book adaptations of bad movies.
There you go. There's your next podcast.
There you go. Yeah, another subset for the Fire and Water Show. The art is probably, again, the same. It looks to me to be the same guys, Ernie Chan and Nestor I'm blanking on his name.
Redondo.
Hey, Nestor Redondo. Thank you very much. It mentions you talked about that you think there's some Alfredo Acala in here, which I could see as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's similar styles amongst a lot of the Filipino artists, so it's kind of hard to tell, but I kind of feel like he might be in there somewhere, it's got that feel of when he was like inking Buscema and Conan, or even when he's doing Newton on Batman later, you just kind of get that, I just kind of picked that up here and there.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, speaking of Batman, I think General Aldo here, he sounds like the voice of a lot of the hero characters. I think he, we're just guessing here, of course, but to me, he sounds like the guy that was Superman on The Man from Krypton, mm-hmm. and Batman in the Robin Meets Man Bat, and the Conan in the Conan one you did. And oddly enough, I think he also played Gorilla Grodd in that Gorilla City Batman record, so kind of fits, I guess.
That would have been a great Power Record. Gorilla Grodd goes to the Planet of the Apes. That would have been fantastic. They could have done.
Yeah, that would be. He would have taken over, I'm sure. You know? Yeah. I thought it was kind of interesting too, because Aldo here is, the way he's portrayed in this record, he's clearly just a warmongering, bloodthirsty villain. Versus Haslin in the previous one, who was, like I said, he actually had, an understandable reason for what he was doing. This guy just wants to fight. He has no,
yeah.
It's like, those guns look yummy,
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that I was cracking up about these Apes movies, and it happens in the fourth film and it happens in this one, is that because of the budgetary limitations, it's like the apes take over one city. And they're like, we are now living on the Planet of the Apes. Like, wait a minute. There's a whole lot of the rest of the world. Like, in Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, they take over Los Angeles. And there's hints that it's a wider conspiracy and that there are other cities being taken over. But you never see any of that. Yeah. And in here, in Battle for the Planet of the Apes, it's like they're fighting one little pocket of humans. And to them, it's like that represents all of humanity. And you're like, well, wait a minute. The Earth is pretty big, as far as I know. I think there probably could be large chunks of the planet that are not ape-controlled at all. There could probably be other countries you don't even know this is happening. So it's sort of funny to me. It sort of reminds me a little bit of, in terms of the geography, you had something you wanted to mention about the previous record that you got to get in because I thought it was hysterical.
Well, the circus owner says – we'll take Caesar to Florida. They'll never find him, And so I'm like, this is the federal government not have any jurisdiction over Florida? I was like, that must be why Shag's there.
they're so prescient, those Power Records writers. They really were. They knew what was blowing in the wind, as it were. This is good stuff. Right. Yeah, it's a fun adaptation. They all fit together, of a piece, and it does end the story, so that's kind of nice. Although there is lots of guys getting shot again.
Yeah.
The bad guy, yeah, he is very cartoony, and the film end adaptation ends in the same ambiguous note that the movie ends, which is the statue starts tearing up, and you don't know whether the tear is a tear of joy, you know, that humans and apes are going to live together, or a tear of sadness that this peace will probably never last.
Yeah.
It's kind of ambiguity is not something you see in modern blockbuster franchises. So the fact that they even did that is still pretty remarkable.
Yeah. There's a couple things with, there's one shot in the comic where it looks like the, when Aldo's telling him, how to shoot a gun, it looks like he splits the skull of the ape that's in front of him.
Yeah.
It's like, wait a minute, ape just killed ape there, it looks like, you know, but, little things like that. I will say this, and not to get into it, but just from reading the comic, as I've listened to it, Caesar and McDonald, there might just be just a little bit more going on than just being buddies there. I'm just saying, you know, the look on Caesar's face in that one panel, just a little, I don't know. I think there's anything wrong.
Who's to say, you know, who's to say what goes on? And I mean, in the Marvel comics, they did get into ape human commingling.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they did get into that. I haven't read them all, but, there is one issue, where, and we mentioned this when I was talking to Scott too, because there were a lot of them written by Doug Minch, who definitely allowed himself to go down alleyways that other writers would not.
Right.
But there was a sequence where a bunch of humans break into like an ape camp, and the ape leader has a human woman as like his consort. And the humans, man, are like, what? You know, like, what? And, you know, you think about it, that's pretty, pretty risque stuff for, again, what's supposed to be a children's entertainment. But at the same time, it's like, it's completely realistic, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it is. It's that probably, if you're living on a planet where these humanoid apes are running things, there's going to be some people out there that are going to just sort of, hey, when in Rome, you know, so.
Right.
Obviously, they did not get into that here. That would have been a little much even for Power Records, so.
Yeah, probably. So, hey, I will cop to this today. Me and my kids watched Howard the Duck today.
Oh, my God. Did they do something wrong? I don't understand.
They were very bad, and I punished them. No, I found this thing. We're going way off topic here, and I apologize. But I found this thing at a flea market for $1.50. And I'm like, hey, why not? $1.50. And the kids kept saying, can we watch it? And I was like, oh, I said, guys, it's horrible. I'm telling you. I don't even know why I bought it. And, so we watched it, and my son was deeply disturbed by the romance between Leah Thompson and Howard.
Yep, yep. I saw that movie in the theater, for the love of God. That is a terrible, terrible movie. And it has stuff that is inappropriate for children. It is. Whoa.
I forgot how inappropriate some of that stuff was. So it's
what a terrible. Oh, thank God there wasn't five films in that franchise. Oy, oh, boy.
But yeah, this, they definitely didn't go there in this. Although, we got suicidal clowns and, people getting gunned down, but not, they didn't go there. So that's fine. So I did like Governor Culp's headgear.
Mm-hmm.
The comic is very Ming-like. I kind of dug that, you know. Was it that way in the movie? Did he have a helmet like that?
It's, kind of. It's not quite that outlandish. But it's somewhat similar.
Yeah, cool.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned Ming the Merciless. Now I think Power Records, I think, was not doing anything new by 1980. I could be wrong about that. I probably am. But I'm just trying to think of all the records of theirs I have. I don't think any of them date to 1980 in terms of new material. I think they were just reissuing things. But boy, Flash Gordon, that would have been right up their alley to do.
Yeah.
You know? Boy, that's a shame they never got a chance to do that. That would have been a... Well, you know what? I take it back, because they did the Star Trek records that were based on the motion picture.
Right.
And that was
right.
1979, so yeah, I guess they could have done it. That's a darn shame, because a Flash Gordon power record that based on the movie, that would have been a trip.
That would have been awesome. Especially if they like adapted the movie and then done some other ones.
Yeah.
Another new story set in the movie version of the universe. Yeah. That would have been great since we never got anything else out of it. You know?
That would have been a blast. So.
Yeah.
So these are the Apes records. Do we have anything else we want to talk about for the Planet of the Apes records, Chris?
I think that's about all I've got.
All right, that's good. So that was it. Those are the four records they did. As I mentioned, Power of Records did do other Apes adventure records, which I am going to get eventually. I don't have a record player anymore, so I don't even know. I couldn't be able to play them even if I bought them, but I do want to own them just for the heck of it. I have all the other ones. So we'll cover them at some other time down the line. I guess we'll cover them for the next Apes movie, which is, you know, whenever that happens after this one, after Dawn of Planet of the Apes, which comes out. Now, before we move on to feedback, I want to ask just one more thing, Chris. Did you see Rise of the Planet of the Apes?
No, I did not.
Okay. So you're probably not going to see this one, right? Because you don't.
I need to. Rise has been one of those. I need to watch that.
It's a great movie.
And yeah, I've heard it's really good. I mean, that's the thing, but it's just, they're not enough hours in the day, you know?
Right. I understand. Now, I really enjoyed it. I didn't, much like a lot of Apes fans, I didn't like the Tim Burton movie.
I did see that, unfortunately.
Yeah, time for that. I didn't like the Burton one at all. And when they announced that they were rebooting it over again, I was skeptical. But I actually really liked Rise quite a bit. And the final scene, I'm not going to give you anything that's a spoiler, but the final scene is such a great tease for what's to come that you're like, oh man, I can't wait to see another installment. And so now that one's here. And one of the things I love about just already Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is the poster. The poster is beautiful. It's got the ape on a horse. I mean, he looks like Urko. It is a classic looking poster. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that they're going for that feel. So I am super excited to see Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And if it's half as good as what people are saying it, how good people are saying it is, I ought to really love it. So I'm looking really forward to it.
Well, the art of movie posters has really just took a nosedive in the last 20 or 25 years. So yeah, it's great to see. They all just look so much alike. So it's great to see one that doesn't.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
It's like
Photoshop
collage.
Yeah, it takes an extra effort to put up like a real painterly poster. Now you know that whoever did had to fight for that to get that done, as opposed to just being Photoshopped head. So yeah, I think it's great. So I'm really looking forward to it, and it comes out. So this episode drops on Monday, July. July 7th. The film comes out on the 11th. So I'm super excited to see it. So, that's it. That's Planet of the Apes. And we have a little bit of listener feedback that I'm going to go over just briefly. Guys, thanks for writing in. As always, you can contact the show at firewaterpodcast@concast.net and the Tumblr. And we'll have some images from these four books on the Tumblr, which is fireandwaterpodcast.tumblr.com. We got an email, message on the Aquaman Shrine from Kyle Benning regarding the Captain America episode, and he mentions, it surprises me how much Captain America got shafted in the 70s. Only one power record and one treasury edition? What the hell was Marvel doing? He was one of the few characters to get a movie, let alone two movies at the time. You think that he must have been fairly popular. Why not cash in on the sales with more Cap power records and treasuries? That's a good question, Kyle. I have no idea why. He was kind of a big character.
Yeah.
He didn't have a regular series, but neither did, you know, some of the other ones. Hulk was really the only one that had an ongoing one. So, right. Yeah, you would think that Cap would have been a bigger deal. But for some reason, yeah.
I would have bought him.
Yeah, I would have bought it. I love Cap's bicentennial battles. Can't beat that. We got a message from Diablo Frank. And he says, I like how we breeze through all those Cap Rogues cameos, especially the forgotten Solar. It's been a long time since anyone recalled that chump. An association with a specific hero has gone cold in readers' minds. I'm sure the extended origin sequence contributed mightily to Baron Zemo being my favorite Cap villain. Helmet would have been much smarter to have worked up some goo-gone hex while he was digging up his father's old patents, though. It never occurred to anybody to say, you know, maybe you could just help him get that damn hood off and, you know. We got an email from Thomas J. Wagner. He says, hi, guys. Just listening to your latest Power Records podcast dealing with Captain America and wanted to let you know that I have the LP sleeve cover that you were looking for. Yes, I pulled a Batman-like boner on the previous episode and said that I wasn't familiar with the LP that featured all four of these Marvel records and that Chris mentioned on the show. I am familiar with it. I have it. My brain just completely went numb at that moment, and I guess the reason I didn't remember it is because it doesn't feature art of the other three heroes. It just features Spider-Man.
Yeah.
So it's a really cheesy looking sleeve. It's clearly not done by Marvel. It was probably done by somebody in house. It's a very pretty cruddy drawing of Spider-Man, and then in sort of handwritten script it says, "Oh, also featuring Fantastic Four and Captain America." You know, yeah. I was like, "Oh, okay." So I do own it. I just completely forgot. But I hate when I do stuff like that on the show that just says something that, because when I hear that, when I hear somebody say something in a podcast I know is wrong, I start yelling into my iPhone. So I can imagine people must do it when I say stuff. So I apologize. But Thomas, thank you for your email, and thanks for following up on that. We got another email from this is really crazy. This is from Lindsay Werner, and she wrote, "Hi, I'm a new listener. I started listening to your show because you were the only Power Records podcast I can find on iTunes. In your last show, you responded to an email and you commented how odd it was that Power Records never made a Doctor Strange record. Well, this isn't directly related to Power Records. There was, in fact, a 17-episode Doctor Strange radio show in 1967.
Whoa.
I bring this up because I thought that you would have mentioned it if you knew. Unfortunately, I haven't heard it. I can't find it anywhere. I stumbled across an article about it when I was looking for Marvel radio shows. You've been involved in audio a lot longer than I have, so maybe you'll have a better idea of where to look than me. If you want to read more about it, here's a link to the interview, and we'll post that link in the show notes. And it is a short blog article called The Secret History of the Doctor Strange Radio Show. And it was, in fact, a locally broadcast radio show starring Doctor Strange.
Wow.
In 1967. And I don't know anything about it more than this article. I've never heard about it. I've never been able to find more. But I have got to find this thing. Because I always loved Doctor Strange, and despite how visually compelling the character is, he would make a great radio show because you could do all his crazy stuff on a budget,
Yeah.
So
theater of the mind.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Theater of the mind. So I have got to find that is an amazing what's out there,
Yeah. Well, I knew there was a Fantastic Four radio show. Right. Like Bill Murray was the Human Torch.
Bill Murray was the Human Torch. That's right.
I knew that, but I sure didn't know there was a Doctor Strange radio show. Wow.
Yeah, that is crazy.
So they could have just adapted, put up some of those episodes on a record, and an album, and put them out.
Done. Yeah, that would have been easy. Yeah. Oh, they've got to be out there. Somebody's got to have them. Everything's out there. You just got to look hard enough. So
yeah, right.
We got an email from Luke Giaconetti. He says, "Rob and Chris, hey guys, just listened to Captain America episode of the Power Records podcast, and wow, another shockingly inappropriate selection for the young Power Records consumers out there. But hey, them's the breaks. Cap sounded great, very sincere, and Falcon sounded good too. I am so glad they didn't try to give him a jive voice or something. The Phoenix seems like he stumbled in from a Republic cereal, but I can dig that. Rob, I loved your story about your mother's recollection of A Phoenix Shall Arise. It's funny the things we remember as parents. Thanks for the great show, guys. Luke." Thank you, Luke. Yeah, it's kind of funny thing to mention, Chris. You are clearly engaging your children with all this geeky stuff.
Yes.
In the case of the Howard the Duck, inappropriately geeky stuff. But it'll be funny to when they're a little older, the stuff you'll remember introducing them to. I mean, it's so funny to me that my mom remembers The Phoenix Shall Arise. That's such a weird thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm guessing you have some of those memories already, right? Because how old are your kids now?
They're 12 and 6. So yeah. Yeah, so my 12-year-old will bring up stuff that, it's like, "Hey, Dad, remember when we watched this?" And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, we did watch that, didn't we?" Or, or "You read me this story," and I'll be talking about something, and he'll remember some nugget from some obscure comic story I read to him. And, of course, he's reading them, obviously, on his own now, and he's going through them. But, yeah, it's really cool, Of course, me being a card-carrying geek, they get lambasted with it, But, yeah, it's cute, the things that they remember. It is strange. And like you said, that story was great about your mom. And then, my parents would, come up with things that I watched, like my dad still remembering Man Bat screeching and things like that. And things from the Adam West TV show that were ludicrous to him, that, he said, "I tried to tell you that stuff was crazy when you were a kid, but you thought it was serious,
We got an email from Zeb Oswald. Zeb can't wait for us to cover the Kojak power record. We'll do that one eventually. We'll do that one eventually. That's another one. Like, what child wants to hear this? Like, who's this for? I don't understand. But
somebody made a Kojak action figure. It was like Mego Light, but it was like Excel or somebody.
Oh, really? Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. It was like offered through one of the catalogs, and it, I think they may have made like two different outfits for him, and maybe like
two different outfits. You get these like fashion plate Kojak.
Yeah.
Oh, him and Barbie can go on double dates and stuff. That's fantastic.
Sure. Why not? And I think they made a cardboard, you know, like office for him, you know, like police headquarters or something like that. It was the 70s, you know, again. That's all you have to say. It was the 70s.
Kids love Telly Savalas. They just do, you know? Okay, you know.
Look, I got my David Caruso action figure.
Yeah.
And here's his office.
Ooh, Hill Street Blues action figure. That's exciting. God's sakes. I shouldn't make a joke about that because Mego actually did buy the license to Hill Street Blues. They never made any figures, but they did buy the license. So
They had Dallas. I mean, what were they thinking? They went to prototype.
Yeah.
There's pictures of those.
That's amazing. Amazing. Yeah. And the final email is from Jake Holmes. He also mentions the long form record that I blanked on. So he brought that up as well. He mentions about that he would totally support a Kickstarter campaign for my Power Records book. He says, I would pledge. Who knows? There may be unreleased Power Records stories in some storage room at Peter Pan Industries in Newark, New Jersey, waiting for you to discover them. Wouldn't that be a trip? Ugh, my mouth's watering at the very idea of it, Jay. And then he mentions, just wanted to pass on the pictures and say thanks for the podcast. Power Records is such a geek niche, but I knew there had to be more of us out there. Please give my regards to Chris, who I think is in Central Kentucky, a couple hours northwest of me. I might have walked past him at the Lexington Comic and Toy Convention 2 weeks ago and never known.
Well, if you may have. I was with a kid dressed as the Matt Smith Doctor Who and a boy and then a little girl dressed as the Flash. So you might have walked past us. Yeah.
We need to make Power Record Podcast t-shirts.
We do.
And then you can go to a Comic-Con and we can wear them and people will know that that's the show that we're from.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Yeah. And I think your book's like going to take on a life of its own. You're going to have to do this. You realize that.
You know, I mean, I don't think I ever want to do another Kickstarter because they are very painful procedures, but it is somewhat tempting because I would love to be able to spend some time of my life researching this stuff and knowing that I was actually, you know, not making money, but not losing money in the process. That would be really cool. And yeah, maybe there is a warehouse somewhere in Newark. It's only a couple hours north of here. So, you know, who knows? Yeah, that would be awesome. So, anyway, that is this. We're done. The super giant ape-sized episode of the Power Records podcast. I want to thank Scott Gardner for coming on and being a guest. That was great. He's a super big apes fan. So that was a lot of fun. And Chris, thanks again for joining me.
Oh, you're no problem. Always glad to be here.
Awesome. So we will come back. We won't make it. We won't let it be so long between episodes. This was like several months between this one and the last one. We'll come back sooner. Maybe we'll do Kojak. Who knows? And, until then, drop the needle and turn the page.
Come, Robin. Into the Batmobile and home.
The only danger is if they send us to that terrible planet of the apes. Wait a minute. Statue of Liberty. That was our planet! You maniacs! You blew it up! Damn you!